everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Rebecca Manley on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, To the Tashkent Station, Evacuation and Survival in the Soviet Union at War. Most people know that the Nazis attacked the Soviet Union in June of 1941, and they made remarkable progress in the first year of the war against the Soviet forces. What is less well known, I think, is that the Soviets did an outstanding job of evacuating millions of Soviet citizens and a considerable amount of their industrial capacity to the east. This is a story that sometimes gets lost in all of the details, and they are fascinating details concerning Operation Barbarossa and then the subsequent Soviet-German conflict. But Rebecca Manley has unearthed a large number of really interesting documents concerning the evacuation and how it transpired. It was planned, but it was also chaotic. It was enormous, but there are a lot of personal stories to be told, too. Also, interestingly, we see the origins, perhaps, of official Soviet anti-Semitism in the evacuation program and the Russian response to it. So all in all, this is a fascinating book. I really enjoyed talking to Rebecca today. And without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
I'm very well. Thank you very much. I'm here in Iowa, and it's beautiful in Iowa. We're having a very nice fall. The corn crop is in, for those of you who have been following the corn crop. I know it was late this year. It was wet fall, but we seem to have gotten a bumper corn crop in. And how's the corn crop in – you're in Ontario, aren't you?
I am in Ontario, and the corn, at least our market, there's no more corn at the market.
Is that right?
We actually did have a very nice fall, but it's rather grim today. It's overcast and gray and sort of wet.
I'm sorry we can't change that. We'll send you some corn from Iowa, though. Actually, all the corn that we produce here is not for human consumption. It's all fed to animals.
That's right. I've read that.
So I should tell our listeners that we have Rebecca Manley on the show today, and we will be talking about her terrific new book, To the Tashkent Station, Evacuation and Survival in the Soviet Union at War. This is a book that I was hoping would be written decades and decades ago because it's an extraordinarily important topic. Most people don't know when they think about World War II, especially Americans, I would say. I won't speak for Canadians, but first of all, they don't know the Soviet Union won it almost single-handedly. But they also don't know that the Soviet Union succeeded in evacuating millions and millions of people. And among them, and this is something I think that Rebecca deserves a certain amount of credit for, among them were Jews who certainly would have been killed during the Holocaust. We don't usually put Russian and philo-Semitism in the same sentence. But in this instance, you know, the story is really one of saving a good portion of an entire people, and I was glad to see that in the book. There were complications, of course, there always are, but I would recommend the book to anyone who's interested in World War II because, again, this was the reality of the first year of the war for the Soviet Union that was moving east. That's what most people were doing, moving east. So, Rebecca, congratulations on the book. Let me begin by asking you to say a few words about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Canada. I was born in the United States, but moved to Canada at 3 months. I grew up in Canada. My great-grandparents were from the Russian Empire. They were from Belarusia. And I was very fortunate that they were alive well through my schooling years. So I always had an interest in Russia. I enjoyed history from an early age. I liked writing, liked reading. But didn't really decide to focus on history until I was making my decisions about what to do in university. And at that point, I had finished my high school education in Italy. I was at a very small international school near the border with what, at the beginning of my time there, was Yugoslavia. By the end, it had broken up, and it was Slovenia. And that summer, I had been admitted to University of Toronto, was going to go there for university, and had to decide what I was going to do, and was carrying around a course catalog with me. This was sort of pre-internet age, and traveling in Eastern Europe, staying with friends I had made at this international school. And I had already become quite interested in history while studying in the school and done a project on women in the Russian Revolution and found it very interesting. But I became kind of convinced that it would be interesting to study Russia and Eastern Europe while traveling in the region and trying to learn a bit of the languages. And so I decided to, when I was registering, I'd study history and I'd study Russian. So I made that decision before my first year of university. And once you put in 5 hours a day, 5 hours rather, of, every morning, 8 or 9 a.m. Russian language classes, for 4 years of university, it's hard to steer off into another track. You already feel like you've made a very big commitment. And I enjoyed history and was fortunate to have a very good history teachers at the University of Toronto. So I was pulled, and of course, because of the family background, I was interested in Russia, and I was able to talk to my grandparents about it. At that stage, I was not at all interested in the war. It was not at all the war that drew me to Russia. But again, the combination of family background and then having made the initial decision to invest time and energy into the language, I was certainly not going to change fields when I decided to keep going with history.
Mm-hmm. And then you go on to graduate school, and this is where you became interested in the Second World War?
Yeah, well, when I applied to graduate school, I was really interested. I was, as I said, not at all interested in the war. I think I'd read nothing. I'd taken numerous courses on in Soviet history as an undergraduate and Soviet politics, and I knew nothing about the war. And I didn't grow up interested in military history at all, so I didn't have the advantage of that background of, at least knowing something about the major battles. I was interested, by the time I went to graduate school, I was interested in the 1920s and the 1930s. I was interested in architecture, domestic architecture. I wanted to do a project on communal apartments and housing design. And I was very keen on this project when I went off to Berkeley. And I think it was after my second or third year, I can't recall now, of graduate school, we had the opportunity to go and do an exploratory research trip in the archives that we planned to be working on for our dissertation. So I went off to Moscow, and I was very excited to start working in the state archives and the party archives, and I started looking for things on housing. And I found some extraordinarily boring accounts of garbage disposal from certain buildings that were certainly not the kind of materials I was interested in. And just by chance, I had ordered some materials in the state archive. I was focusing on the 1930s because that's all of the scholarship I had read dealt with the 1930s. I had read almost nothing about the war, even not only as an undergraduate, but as a graduate student. But there I was looking through some materials, and I saw some materials from the 1940s, and started reading them, and they captivated me. They were stories of people, they were focused on apartments, but they were stories of people who had left their apartments during the war and were desperately trying to reclaim them when they returned from their evacuation in the rear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they, in the process of these letters that were meant to appeal to authorities, they described what they had been through in the course of the war. And all of a sudden, I found myself being pulled into these stories and pulled into a period about which I knew nothing, despite the fact that I've been concentrating on Russian history since my first year of university.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quickly tried to get myself to the Russian military museums and read the big tomes on the history of the war. Of course, my book is not a military history. It's much more of a kind of social, cultural, and political history. But that was what really got me interested in the war, were these stories of loss of home,
mm-hmm.
homelessness.
Mm-hmm. That's a terrific story because the documents lead the topic, as it should be. I mean, I don't know if it always should be, but in this instance, I think it should be. I should also say that I was one of those kids who did grow up reading about World War II all the time. And by the time I got to college, where I was not going to study anything having to do with history, I could name every tank in World War II. This was one of the reasons why I was really looking forward to this book, because I'm a little bit tired of reading about tanks. And all the good tank books have been written. I will tell the people out there that are interested in armored vehicles, but there's no book other than this one that I know about the evacuation. So you really should go out and buy it. I get tank books. I could talk about tank books all day long. But this one, unique, absolutely unique. So after you decided to work on this topic and you wrote the book, and so then after you got the job at Queens, you turned this into your first monograph. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
That's right. So why don't we just begin by telling the story? I mean, I think what most people know is that the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June 22nd, 1941, and things went extraordinarily badly. But there's actually sort of a backstory here that I was interested to see. The Bolsheviks were great planners, and they had a plan for evacuation. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, we do have this, and it's correct what you say, the Bolsheviks were great planners. They loved to plan, and they loved to set up councils and commissions and to draft statutes and to comment on those statutes. And one of the interesting things about the evacuation is that everything I read about the evacuation when I first started researching the topic said that there were no plans. That they actually, despite this tradition of planning and this interest in planning, they had not drafted any plans. And this was the common denominator of all scholarship I saw on the evacuation. And what I found, actually rather late in my research, was that in fact there was a long tradition of planning for evacuation beginning in the 1920s. Much of the early planning for evacuation was based on the experience of the First World War. The First World War was really the orientation point, as it were, for Soviet authorities trying to prepare for the eventuality of another war. And the Soviet authorities were quite convinced there would be another war at some point. This was part of this was an ideological conviction as much as anything else. At some point, the capitalist countries and the new socialist country would have to come into conflict. And their planning for evacuation was, initially evacuation was, what they called evacuation was something that was quite narrow, much narrower than what transpired in the Second World War. And this was simply the removal of important factories and important resources from areas that were threatened by the enemy. So it was an economic measure, an attempt to secure resources. More than anything else. At the same time, in the 1920s, as they were planning for evacuation and trying to designate which areas should be subject to evacuation and which kind of factories, there was also something that was quite separate, which was planning for refugees. Of course, the First World War, and this is something that some listeners may not realize either, but during the First World War in the Russian Empire, there were a tremendous number of people on the move. There were some 3 million people who were uprooted, either left on their own or were actually uprooted by the Russian army. And so the Bolsheviks were very aware that this was a potential reality of war. And they were convinced that in the next war, there would be even more refugees than in the First World War. Why? Because this would be an ideological war. And so there would be a new category of refugees, political refugees. But they were in the 1920s, they were quite, you know, they were worried about refugees, and they knew it had created all sorts of problems, health problems, logistical problems, but they didn't really think they could do much about it. And what I found in my research when I was looking through the plans and looking through the correspondence over the plans was that there was a real sea change in planning in the 1930s. And this corresponded to some of the dramatic changes taking place in the Soviet Union in that period. And this was when Stalin became the kind of undisputed leader of the country and inaugurated major changes in the end of the 1920s and early 1930s, the industrialization of the country, the rapid industrialization, collectivization, and the introduction of passports. So whereas in the 1920s, planners had been kind of trying to think about how they would deal with this inevitable deluge of people that they expected to occur in a future war. In the 1930s, they started saying, well, you know, there shouldn't be any refugees in a future war. Mm. We won't permit any refugees. And something that had seemed rather outlandish when it had been proposed in the 1920s, it seemed outlandish in the 1920s, suddenly became sounded very reasonable, because this was a moment in which the freedom to travel had been seriously restricted by the introduction of internal passports. And it was increasingly there was an increasing tendency to view civilians in the same way that one might view people in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So to think about civilian mobilization. And so by the end of the 1930s, or by the eve of the war, there was no longer any refugee planning because there weren't going to be any refugees in this war. Instead, there would only be evacuees. The significance is that the idea was that only people who had been designated by the state would be able to move, would be transferred to the rear. And those that had not been designated would be forced to stay and forced in some proposals, this actually involved, you know, setting up battalions to prevent people from fleeing to the rear.
Mm-hmm.
So by the eve of the Second World War, there was a very definite, there had been all sorts of discussions and plans involving the Committee of Defense and the Commissariat, the Ministry of Transportation, and the Internal Affairs, and all sorts of authorities involved in these debates, with the result that there was a definite sense that evacuations would be required in a future war. There was a commitment or a notion that voluntary displacement, i.e. displacement that was not initiated by the state, would not be permitted. But there were very few concrete plans. And it was a few weeks before the actual invasion of the Soviet Union that a draft statute was drawn up stipulating who should be drawing up actual plans. I found the statute is, I think it was dated something like 3 weeks before the invasion. Nothing happened in those intervening weeks. And hence the common perception that there was actually no planning, because although there was a lot of discussion about evacuation, there were very few concrete plans put into place.
Mm-hmm. So, what happened after June 22nd, 1941? People were not aware that there was a plan, so I guess they didn't follow any plan.
Well, yeah, one of the things there were in the areas that were, of course, June 22nd, 1941, German forces invade all across the front lines. As most people know, their advance was extraordinarily rapid. So some places there wasn't even time to even think about an evacuation. They were occupied before they even knew it. Evacuation orders were issued in some regions without central authorization. In Latvia, for instance, there were evacuation orders issued. But very quickly, authorities started scrambling, contacting the central authorities in Moscow, saying we need to do something. And Stalin at first was very skeptical. In the first days of the war, Stalin was still planning a counteroffensive that would launch Soviet troops onto enemy territory. This, of course, was wildly unrealistic given what was unfolding at the front. But he clearly wasn't fully grasping the reality of the situation. And the authorities in Belarus actually had to contact him and push him and say, we need to. This was 2 days after the invasion. It was already becoming late to evacuate the capital of Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
So in very short order, a commission was actually established, an evacuation council in Moscow. And this council was supposed to take charge of the evacuation and ensure that evacuations happened where they needed to, and that those sectors of the population and those factories and other resources that needed to be evacuated would be evacuated.
Mm-hmm. And were they?
It's a difficult question to answer. I mean, in some ways, on a global scale, if you step back and look at the evacuation, what Soviet authorities achieved, given the circumstances, is quite remarkable. They evacuated over 1,000 kind of enterprises or factories. Many of these were up and running within a year of evacuation. They evacuated large numbers of resources, and large numbers of people were evacuated also.
Mm-hmm.
So there is certainly there's a success story here, and a success story I think that's not that's an important one in understanding how the Soviet Union actually survived the first 2 years of the war.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent, though, you mentioned this in the book, to what extent did people simply evacuate themselves, so to say?
Right. Well, this is one of the interesting, curious terms that I came across in doing my research was spontaneous self-evacuation. This is a term, very Soviet.
As opposed to running away.
Exactly. In other words, running away. Yeah. And this was clearly a term that was used by authorities to describe situations they were clearly displeased about. But instead of being evacuated, people were spontaneously self-evacuating, which was, of course, not part of the plan, which was exactly what was exactly the part of this whole phenomenon that planners in the 1930s had sought to stamp out. They didn't want anything spontaneous happening. Everything was supposed to be state directed. Mm-hmm. When we look at the total numbers, it's hard to know how many of the people who actually ended up in the interior were evacuated and how many spontaneously self-evacuated. But it's quite clear that many of the people, there were, you know, I would say, the number of people who fled on their own were in the millions. Mm-hmm. And this was in part a function of the restrictions that Soviet authorities put on who could be evacuated. And it was a part a function of the fact that evacuations were often started so late that even those categories of the population that would have been subject to an official evacuation couldn't officially be evacuated, and so they ended up fleeing.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is the era of internal passports, and so I'm trying to imagine what would happen if I, being a good citizen of Minsk, decide that I'm just going to head to Moscow now, even though I'm not propisana, even though I don't have the right internal passport. What happened to these people? Were they checked, or was there general amnesty for people that weren't in the right place? How did the Soviets deal with
that? Yeah, that's an interesting question, because people, of course, at this point, because of the passport regime, people did have to have authorization to travel. Martial law had been introduced also with the onset of war, which imposed further restrictions on travel. People who tried to go to Moscow, of course, that would have been a good destination. That would have been a smart place to try to get to. That was the most difficult place to enter. Restrictions on the capital, entrance into the capital, became very rigid, and there were detachments, NKVD, detachments that would actually stop people from going into the capital. And of course, they were interested. They were concerned about spies. They didn't really care so much about the individual spontaneous self-evacuee, although that was another mouth to be fed, and they were still trying to maintain the capital was a privileged place to reside in. So some lowly, you know, person from the Belarusian countryside would not be welcome in Moscow. But so it would be very difficult to get to Moscow as somebody without the proper papers. But one of the things that's striking is that despite the whole system of controls that had been set up over the previous decade, controls on movement, there were, you know, it was warm. Perhaps this is not surprising because of the wartime conditions, but it was exceedingly easy if you managed to get onto a train. That was the difficulty. But if you managed to get onto a train, it was exceedingly easy to get basically wherever you wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. And why is that exactly? One thinks of the Soviet Union as a place that is, as they say about police states, they're very good at policing.
Right.
So in this instance, how could you just get on a train during wartime and all this chaos?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. I mean, it was difficult to get onto a train was difficult. It was difficult because almost depending on the circumstances, but almost invariably trains were leaving when bombs were already falling. There were clearly places were being reserved for the elites, as defined by Soviet authorities. So getting a seat on a train might be difficult, but if you managed to get on somewhere, bribery was very common. So if you were checked and your papers weren't in order, it was very easy to bribe authorities. The resources of the state were also stretched to the absolute maximum during the war. It's clear even from studies of the 1930s, even from studies of the terror from the late 1930s, that somebody who was targeted, if they simply wandered off into the countryside, they might avoid arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Most people weren't willing to simply leave their homes and wander off into the countryside, but you could avoid arrest that way. That the reach of the state, although real, certainly had serious limits.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that very clearly, especially during the war, when resources were stretched again to their limits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so many people who would previously have been doing this kind of work had been conscripted into the army.
Mm-hmm.
And just the number of people. So often, trains would be station masters would have all of these people arrive. They weren't supposed to send them on, but stations were getting clogged. You had to send people somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So people just get shunted on to the next spot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was going to ask about that. So say, for instance, I do make it from Minsk to Moscow with my meager possessions. I have my internal passport, but I'm not registered in Moscow. And what do I do then? Do I camp out at the train station? Where do I live?
You probably would camp out at the train station. Being in Moscow without official papers would be very difficult, especially during the war. You wouldn't have access to rations. Without access to rations, you'd be forced to sell your meager possessions, which might get you food for a short while, but not for long. So you would probably be ending up at the station. And what police did is they would send people who ended up in Moscow out. You would not be sent back to the front lines. You'd be sent further east.
Mm-hmm. I see, which is kind of what I wanted anyway. By the fall of 1941, it looked as if Moscow was going to be captured itself, which would put further pressure on people to leave. And one of the most fascinating things that you talk about in the book, and this is something I honestly did not know, I knew that there were plans to evacuate the elite in Moscow in October, but I did not know there were plans to evacuate the whole city. And this apparently had a great impact on people. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the story of Moscow in October of 1941 is a fascinating one. It's this was, as you said, by October of 1941, Moscow started becoming quite clear that Moscow itself was under threat. Evacuations from Moscow had begun almost as soon as the invasion itself. Moscow was the capital of the country. It was the pinnacle of power, and it was its residents were privileged. So evacuations had begun already in the summer, mainly of children with their mothers often. But in October, as enemy forces approached the city, the government itself started an evacuation plan of not simply women and children, although they continued to evacuate them, but of the government an accelerated evacuation of the city's factories and of much of the population as well. This was a critical moment in the war. The capital was indeed evacuated to the Volga city of Samara. Stalin himself was slated for a possible evacuation. In the end, he didn't leave. He remained in the capital. But once it became clear that a whole host of institutions in the city were being evacuated, at an accelerated rate, rumors spread like wildfire through the city that the government was being evacuated, that Stalin had left. And very quickly, not surprisingly, panic set in. Tens of thousands of people unable to procure train tickets, because train tickets at this point, again, in this moment of heightened anxiety, were being distributed only through official channels. So those unable to procure train tickets were leaving on by foot, by car if they had the opportunity. And the whole city ceased to function for a couple of days. The newspaper wasn't issued. The metro didn't run. People showed up at work, and there was nobody there. The city came to a standstill, something that hadn't happened since Soviet power had really been established in Moscow. And there were wild rumors going through the city, not simply that Stalin was leaving, but that the Germans had already reached the outskirts of the city. People started burning their party cards, convinced that the city would soon be in the hands of the Germans. And I read a lot of diary accounts, memoir accounts, but also diary accounts and letters that were written in this period. And one of the striking things that people noted was that for the first time, since the establishment of Soviet power, you could hear people openly cursing Soviet power on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
There was a sense that this experiment in socialism was in its dying days, that the Soviet Union was indeed on the brink of collapse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think, though, that the thing that struck me was that it took a measure as severe as the Germans literally being on the outskirts of Moscow and an evacuation order to begin the process of disintegration. I was thinking, again, this really isn't a fair crack, but in order to shut an American city down, all you have to do is turn the lights out. And people start to burn and loot and run rampant and wild in the streets. And this was much more severe pressure, much more unimaginably more pressure. And I think that bespeaks a certain social solidarity that we don't associate with the Soviet Union. I think people really hung in there for a long time until things went badly.
I think that's absolutely true, and that's one of the things that I tried to kind of draw out in the book, is that there really was, that the war in some ways, I mean, the war challenged the Soviet power more seriously than anything had up until that point. I mean, it did seem to be on the brink of collapse, and yet at the same time, it drew many people together, and there was a certain stoicism, and a real sense of duty and obligation. And one of the interesting things about the breakdown in Moscow is, you're right, absolutely, this was a moment of intense pressure that's difficult to kind of to imagine. But the most common sentiment expressed, at least in the sources that I had access to, by Soviet citizens was a sense of, about the events of those days, was a sense of shame. Mm-hmm. That the kind of stoic endurance the city had displayed until that point broke down. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to precisely that sense of kind of social solidarity that you're talking about. And in some sense, it's interesting. One of the things that I also found interesting, the war, of course, comes only a few years after the terror. And it's not uncommon to find in memoirs of people who were affected by the terror, whose family members were arrested, et cetera, a sense that people actually put it this way, the war erased the memory of the terror. Mm-hmm. That the war, other people said the war for the first time in years made them feel Russian. Mm-hmm. So it's not that there was necessarily this sense of solidarity over the previous 20 years, but the war created a new sense of solidarity because there was a common exterior enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, ordinarily, in situations like this, when there's a lot of pressure of this sort, divisions appear in society pretty quickly. And we know that in the American case, they appear remarkably quickly. But I guess I am I'm just struck about the sort of homogeneity of the response. You know, sometimes people make a distinction between Jews and non-Jews, or people from the South and people from the North, and Ukrainians and Belarusians and Russians and so on and so forth. But I don't see very much of that in your book, that really it was the case that they were all threatened here. Although I should say, and let's talk a little bit about this, there was a decision as to whether one should go or leave Moscow in October or not. And there were some interesting rumors floating around about the intentions of the Germans. One of the things I was fascinated to find out is that people were saying, well, the Germans really are only after the communists and the Jews, so we might stay safely. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is an interesting. I mean, this dilemma to stay or to go was something that every family, every individual had faced. Because even if you weren't designated for evacuation, there was always the possibility of you know, so-called spontaneous self-evacuation. And so it was something that everybody talked about. And it really, for many people, the terms of the debate were quite interesting. Many people. Or some people felt like that they had a responsibility to leave, that it would be absolutely unconscionable to end up in the hands of the German fascists. So for some people, there was a kind of either a patriotic or a kind of ideological imperative to depart. But for others, and for some people, I should say, there was a patriotic imperative to remain because you had to fight. So it was a complex. A complex moment. There were people, and this is also very interesting in the case of Moscow. It clearly surfaced that people who had never been, supporters of Soviet power, came out of the woodwork in this period. And there are a number of memoirs who commented on the way that this moment, the moment of decision to stay or to go, really revealed the divisions of the population. That those people who were critical of Soviet power saw remaining as their chance their chance to get out of the hold or to escape the hold of the Soviet state, and to try their luck in a different kind of political, under a different kind of political regime.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't supporters of fascism, or most of them. I haven't seen any cases, but they were certainly anti-Soviet, and so this was a chance to escape the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. At what point did people understand that the Germans, and I think it's actually quite early, but at what point did people understand or believe that the Germans were there for purposes other than strictly occupation? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, right. Well, this is a difficult question. And one of the things people had, this Soviet citizens who were trying to make sense of the situation, it was a complicated situation to make sense of, had a number of sources of information. They had the newspapers, the official Soviet newspapers, which told them that the Germans were there for more than the occupation. Only rarely did the newspapers single out Jews, however.
Mm-hmm.
The newspapers did say that the Germans were there to enslave the population.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't say they were there, that they didn't mention the genocide of Jews, although they did talk about anti-Semitism sometimes. So the newspapers were one source of information. Rumors were in many ways a much more important source, and rumors were fed by the masses of people who were coming from the front lines and coming with stories of what was actually going on. And this is something that people talked about a lot. What were the Germans really after? The notion that Germans were after only communists and Jews was pervasive. And it was said in part by official, by things that people actually knew about the Germans from the pre-war era and from the early war era.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in some ways, the Soviets classified that as a defeatist rumor.
Mm-hmm.
Defeatist because it reassured others that they didn't have anything to worry about, which of course wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Germans did not carry out, a genocide of Ukrainians or Russians, they were treated extraordinarily badly. There were policies of enforced starvation in areas. So of course these rumors weren't true, but there was very little knowledge. There was a failure of imagination, a completely understandable one, a failure to conceive that occupation could in fact be
mm-hmm.
As brutal as it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And there were for the older generations, there were memories of the First World War. People remembered the German troops and remembered them as civilized, and were all too willing to attribute what they read in the Soviet newspapers to a propaganda effort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a skepticism about official sources that also fed this, this perspective or this reluctance to believe that the Germans would in fact commit this type of atrocities. And even if you did think that occupation was going to be difficult, you had to weigh that against what would happen were you to simply leave your home. And that was a big unknown. In the Soviet Union of this era, in the Stalin era, to leave your home, first of all, if you did it without authorization, you risked cutting yourself off from all of the important distribution networks that sustained you, the institutional networks and your patronage networks, all of these networks that sustained you, you were risk cutting yourself off from.
Mm-hmm.
And people had very little faith that the state would, in fact, look after them in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I was going to mention that there was kind of a cry wolf moment here because the press was not entirely trustworthy, let's say, during the 20s and 30s, and they made a lot of stuff up. And then when the Germans came, they really didn't have to make anything up anymore because the events on the ground were bad enough that if simply reported, they would scare most people straight. But they had lost some degree of credibility, although I think so many Soviet citizens had contact with the Germans, especially through the armed forces, that they quickly realized that what was in Izvestia and Pravda was not some sort of dark fantasy of the Communist Party. In fact, the Germans were there for very, very nefarious purposes. I want to take our story past Moscow. So once, let's just take our hypothetical Belarusian citizen again, past Moscow, and he gets evacuated or she gets evacuated to the east. And the place that you focus on is Tashkent. Why Tashkent?
For a number of reasons. I think Tashkent in part, for a couple of, important reasons. Tashkent was one of the most sought-out destinations for a wide swath of Soviet citizens, ranging from some of the kind of literary and cultural elites, people like poet Anna Akhmatova, Alexei Tolstoy, all sorts of musicians. So it was a sought-out destination among elites, and it was also a sought-out destination for large numbers of Jews who were coming mainly from the south, from southern Ukraine and southern Russia. In Tashkent, there had been a novel written, and this is one of those cases where literature, you can see its impact. There had been a novel written in the 1920s called Tashkent, City of Bread, and it had been translated into Yiddish, and if you'd read the novel, you wouldn't be so eager to go to Tashkent, because it really doesn't turn out to be the kind of mecca that the title would suggest. But this novel, everyone had heard of Tashkent, City of Bread. If you're weighing Siberia versus Tashkent, well, Tashkent is in the south. Never mind that when they get there, everybody complained of the climate. I never read a single letter by anyone who did not complain of the climate in Tashkent. But certainly, if you're looking at it from an abstract point of view, here's this place that's supposed to be a city of bread. It's not Siberia. It seems to be in the south. You're going to be warmer. And if you're looking at it in comparison to other non-Russian republics, Tashkent had a sizable Russian-speaking population, not Belarusian-speaking population, but a sizable Russian population, Ukrainian population. And so there might not be the language difficulties you would encounter.
I think it's important to say, though, for our listeners who don't know, that Tashkent is not in Russia, and it's quite a ways from Russia, and is in fact in Uzbekistan, and Uzbekistan itself was kind of a made-up place.
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing, this is one of the things that drew me to Tashkent. Tashkent was not the city that received the most, in numerical terms, the greatest number of evacuees. But, for me, this was an interesting part of the story. These people who came from Belarusia, from Russia, from Ukraine, found themselves in a city that was very foreign in many ways. It was, although there were large numbers of Russian speakers there who had migrated over the years, it was an Uzbek city and Tajik city, but it had a bit of another story. So it was an Uzbek city. The language was foreign. The architecture was different
that region had only been incorporated into the Russian Empire rather late in the game, in the latter half of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that made the city of interest to me was to see it. I think it helps get at to what degree, partly to what degree, was this region really incorporated into the Soviet Union. Many people felt themselves to be refugees, entering a kind of foreign world. But what we see is that even though Tashkent and Uzbekistan, in many ways, had not been fully Sovietized, that people who arrived there knew very well how to manage the situation. Soviet institutions were sufficiently entrenched that when writers arrived in the Soviet capital, in the Uzbek capital, for instance, they knew right away to go to the Writers' Union. And so the institutional landscape of the cities that was in Tashkent was very similar to the institutional landscape that people had left behind, and so this is, I think the case of Tashkent is interesting in that regard, because it does make a point about how much the Soviet Union had created a kind of a uniform. Mm-hmm. Institutional world. It was also interesting because it highlighted this question that you raised earlier about social solidarity. Here was a place that in which you had people of a huge number of different ethnic groups living together during the war. Tashkent was celebrated in many ways as a kind of symbol of the friendship of nations. And this was the friendship of peoples, the friendship of nations was a kind of concept that had been developed over the previous decade. But it was touted during the war because in the war on the front lines, you had Uzbeks fighting alongside Ukrainians, fighting alongside Russians, et cetera. And the Tashkent capital, which welcomed so many Russians and Ukrainians and Jews, along with Belarusians and Latvians, et cetera, was seen as a kind of a model of this friendship. And so one of the things that was, and one of the things that became a real symbol of this was, were the international adoptions, or I shouldn't say inter-ethnic adoptions, I should say. In Uzbekistan, there were these famous cases that were reported all over the Soviet Union of these Uzbek families who adopted, you know, 15, 16 children, each of a different ethnicity, and made them their own. So I was interested in Tashkent, in part, again, because it attracted such a diverse group of people, and in part because it was also a way to examine both the myth and the reality of the Friendship of Nations.
Just a couple of background questions. How big was Tashkent before the in-migration?
The population had grown quite a bit over the previous decade. It was the number of people who came. I think it was about 500,000 or 600,000. There had been an administrative reorganization shortly before the war, but I think it was about 600,000.
And then during the – how many people came into Tashkent to live?
Well, this is a pretty difficult question, and I spent a lot of time trying to piece together various statistics. Because of some of the problems that we talked about earlier, the way that people could simply slip through the kind of official channels, counting during the war was incredibly difficult. Official estimates put the number of evacuees in Tashkent at 100,000. I think there were certainly more. The Tashkent station was one of the, was a station that I won't say, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people went through. Tashkent was one of those cities, like Moscow, that was very hard to gain access to. It was supposed to be reserved for people who had been designated for evacuation. This was a place that was off limits for the spontaneous self-evacuees. And there were a whole set of regulations trying to restrict access to the city. But, of course, we have plenty of stories of people who were able to make their way into Tashkent and live there at least for some time before being evicted or before leaving because of the hardship.
We should also say that these people, by and large, did not come as individuals. Soviet society was corporatist, I guess I would call it. Everybody belonged to something that usually got them I can even remember being, when I was in the Soviet Union the first or second time, I don't know, but I remember getting eggs from the people at the archive. I don't know why they got a distribution of eggs, but that's how we got eggs. They got the egg shipment at the archive, and so we got some eggs. But so people came actually as members of their unions or members of their collectives. Is that correct? In these things called echelons. They use this odd word, echelon.
Yes. No, this is right. And this is, for me, this was one of the interesting aspects of the story, that I think the way the evacuation was organized really does cast light on the way Soviet society functioned, that people, those who were evacuated in what they called organized fashion, i.e. not the people who fled, were evacuated in this kind of corporate fashion with their workplace. And those are the people who were most well looked after. So if you were a writer and you were evacuated with the writer's union, the head of the writer's union sent telegrams onto the stations you passed through to make sure that you were provided with food along with the route. Of course, writers were privileged, but these organizations would ensure that you had somewhere to live when you arrived, that you were linked up to a cafeteria so that you would have food, because salaries simply weren't enough to live on, and you hear that repeated by people in every source you can imagine. So you needed to be linked up to some kind of official distribution network, and this was one of the reasons people were hesitant to leave on their own. Leaving on their own meant abandoning those kind of networks that were so crucial to survival. So Tashkent officially was only to be accessible to those arriving in kind of organized fashion who had been designated to arrive in the city. But it's very clear that for many people, if their factory or their workplace was not being evacuated, they're very reticent, again, to leave the security of these networks, knowing that in a new place they would have to be able to kind of get into some kind of institutional distribution network, because workplace was who you worked for, your kind of was key not only to your salary, but also to access to cafeterias, access to housing. So housing was organized along these lines as well, and thus key to survival.
It seems as if the entire situation was structured in such a way to encourage, I was going to say, a criminal activity, but perhaps misdemeanors is a better word for it, that people were going to be working on the edges of propriety in order to survive. Do we have a lot of evidence of that?
We have ample evidence of that, both from memoirs and from the perennial, you know, party reports that complain about instances of misdemeanors. Bribery was a big problem. Another problem that everybody complained about in Tashkent was what was called blat, which is a kind of system of favors. So people complained that you couldn't get housing unless you knew people. You couldn't get work unless you knew people. We have evidence of factories employing, and I say employing in quotation marks, employing people who had absolutely nothing to do with these factories, or none of their training had any relevance to what the factory did. And clearly it was a case that somehow either the person knew the factory director or they bribed them, and the factory agreed to inscribe them on the names of their employees to get them housing, to get them access to cafeterias, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the police in there would uncover cases like this.
I knew of cases like that in the 80s in the Soviet Union, of people that
absolutely
were assigned to work at various places, and I got to know them, and they never went. And I sort of asked them about this, like, "Why don't you have to go to work?" And, "No, I don't have to go to work." I said, "Don't you work here?" "I work there, yes." Like, I don't understand that. But anyway, go ahead.
Right. No, well, it's true. This had begun well before the war. So this is kind of the importance of these relations. But it made displacement particularly precarious. I mean, displacement in any condition, in any circumstance, is perceived by people usually as a calamity, and it's difficult and precarious. It puts you in a precarious position. But in the Soviet Union, when knowing people and having these kind of institutional connections was so important to survival, displacement raised particular perils.
And what did the Soviet authorities do with displaced persons? What did they do with people that had fallen through the cracks and were not affiliated with any organization or institution, that were basically homeless? What did they do with those populations?
Well, they expelled them from the major cities. So the cities, again, were conceived of as privileged places. So people in Tashkent would get rounded up and sent to the countryside, which many people felt was a death sentence. In the countryside, especially in a place like Uzbekistan, there were communication problems. So there were lots of problems reported of displaced people having trouble communicating with their Uzbek hosts. Collectivization had not been kind to the countryside, and certainly there were food shortages in the countryside as well. Some people wanted to be in the countryside, thought they'd be closer to the source of food, and it was exceedingly difficult to find work.
Did people starve to death?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. They did.
And do we have any figures on that at all?
It's very difficult to know the numbers. The number of deaths spiked dramatically. Just the number of people dying in Tashkent spiked dramatically. And even if you offset that by the increase in population, of course, there was a decrease in the sense of so many people were mobilized to the front. So even if you kind of control for that, there's a sharp increase in the number of deaths in 1942. 1942 is the most difficult year of the war. And often, you know, people starve to death, but they die often of other, you know, diseases that they become vulnerable to, typhus, for instance. But it was not uncommon to see dead bodies around the train station. Mm-hmm. In the memoir literature and diaries, you hear death is omnipresent. People are they see bodies that have not been cleared off the streets. I found, you know, discussions about the lack of space in the local cemeteries, especially the Jewish cemetery. They had to really expand because there simply weren't enough spots to bury people.
I want to talk a little bit about the symbolic nature of the evacuation and how it particularly, if I understood what you say correctly, affected, I guess, what I'd call Soviet folk attitudes toward Jews. My understanding had always been that anti-Semitism was waning in Russia before the war. And I also know for a fact that anti-Semitism was, I think, what they called a violation of party discipline. It was strongly discouraged.
Yeah.
And people could be sanctioned severely for it. But something happens during the evacuation. It becomes associated with Jews, and then a kind of return to what I sometimes call civil anti-Semitism appears. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this is one of the really interesting phenomenon of the war. On the one hand, clearly the evacuation saved countless numbers of Jews from basically certain death in occupied territory. At the same time, it really did give rise to a new wave of anti-Semitism. And I think what you said a moment ago is true, that anti-Semitism had been on the decline before the war. And you know, anecdotally, in the sources that I looked at, I came across numerous people who commented that they were surprised that they hadn't encountered these kind of attitudes in the Soviet Union before. So anecdotal evidence that suggests that this indeed is a new phenomenon with the evacuation. The evacuation, as I said, the Soviet authorities did not actually target Jews for evacuation, although they knew quite early on that Jews were in fact in greater danger than other Soviet citizens of being killed by the occupation forces. They never targeted Jews as Jews for evacuation. But there was, Jews did flee in greater numbers, in no small measure because of the rumors and the knowledge of German anti-Semitism and the rumors about what might await them should they fall into occupied territory. Jews were also evacuated in greater numbers because they had come to occupy disproportionate disproportionate proportion of party. The groups that were subject to evacuation happened to have disproportionately large numbers of Jews, mm-hmm. party members, writers, the cultural elite, etc. Mm-hmm. So there was a common perception that Jews were fleeing. And this was in part a function of a real situation that was created by the nature of the German invasion. And of course, it was also wildly exaggerated. There were people who thought that, you know, all of Moscow was Jewish and had fled, and so there was wild exaggeration. But this perception that Jews took flight, I think, was crucial in sparking a new wave of anti-Semitism. And Tashkent became a kind of symbol of that. There was a common joke that originated in the war and then became very popular after the war that, you know, the Jew over there served on the Tashkent front.
Yeah.
He bought his medals in Tashkent.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was, of course, you know, one of the places that was furthest from the actual front lines.
Uh-huh.
And so there was this kind of perception that Jews had fled from service.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And although Jews had, in fact, left in disproportionate numbers, they were also very well represented in the army. So that mm-hmm. wasn't borne out. But those stories were not publicized by the Soviet
mm-hmm.
state.
Mm-hmm. How did the party react to these rumors? Because it would seem to me they would also be sort of defeatist and counter-revolutionary. Did they take any affirmative steps to fight them?
Well, they did. It's interesting. When I was working in the Moscow party archives, you mentioned earlier that anti-Semitism was something that you could be, you know, severely reprimanded for, and I did still find cases of people, you know, somebody on a bus making an anti-Semitic remark in early, you know, in the month following the invasion, suffering consequences for it. And in some cases, party members actively tried to undermine these notions, in part because it made people complacent, or at least that was the perception, that if the Nazis were only targeting Jews, so Jews were the ones who were fleeing, then clearly nobody else had anything to worry about. So why fuss about the war effort? But one of the things that certainly on at least a kind of anecdotal level and the sources that I had access to and read is that the efforts to combat this kind of anti-Semitism became much less pronounced over the course of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And people were often surprised to hear party members making remarks of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because they expected party members to be the ones who would discount this kind of mm-hmm. This kind of claim about Jews being cowards and not fulfilling their service.
Mm-hmm.
But the state, I think, in part, the Jewish question just became very central state authorities became very concerned about mm-hmm. associating the war with Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically stayed off the topic. And it also opened up a space, I think, for popular anti-Semitism to grow. And of course, in evacuation, since many evacuees were perceived as Jews, there were many Jews, and so that further fed the flames of anti-Semitism because there were invariably conflicts over scarce resources. And with the return of evacuees at the end of the war, this also, especially in the formerly occupied territories, which had also been subjected to, you know, had lived through it a couple of years at least of Nazi propaganda, when Jews returned, there were real conflicts, which further fed the flames of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, this is something that was always a mystery to me. I was wondering if we could make a connection between this sort of upswelling of, I guess I'd call it ground roots anti-Semitism and the more or less official anti-Semitism that begins almost immediately after the war. That is the campaign against, I guess they were called rootless cosmopolitans, if I recall correctly, during the, what was it called, the Zhdanovshchina. Is there any, can we draw any arrows there or anything like that?
I think absolutely. I think there's a real connection here, and it's an interesting moment to see the kind of connection between kind of official policy and popular attitudes. You know, the official anti-Semitism you see already starting to bear its face in the very early years of the war, already in 42-43, even in Tashkent, which is far from Moscow, people start becoming aware of a new central policy. In the film industry, people start getting dismissed. Just so happens that those people are people with Jewish last names. So people, that the official policy starts changing early, and I think it does have a significant impact on popular attitudes. When people start returning to the places they had left at the end of the war, there's a popular perception that Jews weren't allowed to return. This is not the case. I've not found a single document that says, you know, Jews were not, you know, that directs authorities to forbid Jews from returning. And Jews do, in fact, return in large numbers. But because of this official policy of divesting Jews of their position in various kind of cultural and political institutions, that creates a kind of expectation or perception among the population at large that Jews are no longer welcome in liberated Ukraine, for instance. And so there's a kind of feedback mechanism, and it gives greater license, I think, to the population, and also to attempt to actually bar Jews from returning, and makes certainly gives the impression that it's now okay to be anti-Semitic.
I think I see your next book. I'm going to talk a little bit on the pre-interview, but I certainly would like to hear about the wartime origins of the Zhdanovshchina and the campaign against rootless cosmopolitans, because I never understood it, not for a second, until reading your book. I should say also we've taken up a lot of your time, Rebecca. We've been talking to Rebecca Manley about her new book, To the Tashkent Station, Evacuation and Survival in the Soviet Union at War. And I want to thank you for being on the show. I want to conclude, though, with our traditional final question on new books in history, and that is, aside from my suggestion, which you can throw in the trash, what is your next project? What are you going to work on now, other than raising children?
one of the things that I've thought about that I became quite interested in when I started work on this project and through my work on the project was the way the war, not simply the evacuation, but the war more generally, was remembered in the Soviet Union. And possibly in the post-Soviet era. One of the things that really struck me when I was working on the project, although all of my studies about the Soviet Union had always focused on the 1930s, if you talk to the older generations, when I first started going to Russia in the early 1990s, if you talk to them and started asking them questions about their past, they were much more interested in talking about the war than they were most other periods. And I was interested in what kind of meaning the war had had for this this older generation. As I said, the war in some ways was a moment of, although it was a moment of greatest suffering in many ways, certainly numerically, the number of Soviet citizens who died during the war is just, you know, is difficult to fathom. It's so large. So it was a moment of, it was in many ways, you know, certainly the 1930s weren't easy with collectivization and the terror, et cetera. But this was a moment of intense suffering, but it's also a moment that Soviet citizens seem to identify with. Mm-hmm. And some people even refer to it as, you know, the best time of their lives. This was a time when there was a sense of social solidarity.
I guess I would say there was a, in hindsight, it looks that way because, you know, one of the things I've been doing recently, this is simply an aside, is I've been looking at, in association with an entirely different project, I've been looking at newspaper debates in the United States during World War II. And we have this notion here that it was the greatest generation and everything was hunky-dory and we went and defeated the Germans and the Japanese and everybody went back to their white picket fence. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, people were, you know, like, for example, just to institute the draft was like pulling teeth in the United States. To lower the draft age to 18 in the United States was like pulling teeth. People didn't want to do this. They weren't convinced that they needed to go fight in Europe. It really was not let's go and defeat the fascists. It just wasn't like that, even though now, thanks to Tom Brokaw, a fine person, we have this notion that this was the greatest generation and they just marched off to war. So I imagine what you'd find is that people's recollection of this thing is very different than what actually happened. And that makes you perfectly suited to write the book because you know what happened. Well, Rebecca, I want to say thanks very much again for being on the show. Let me repeat the title of the book again so that you can buy your children new shoes. To the Toshkent Station, Evacuation and Survival in the Soviet Union at War. It's just come out from Cornell University Press. I should also put a plug in for Cornell. They have, I think, the best Russian history list in the United States and probably the world. So it's a terrific publisher to publish with. And I want to congratulate them for publishing the book. Rebecca, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Rebecca Manley about her new book, The Toshkent Station, Evacuation and Survival in the Soviet Union at War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I'll be back next week.